Welcome to your personalized deep dive. This time, it's all about the pressures facing democracies.
Yeah, those pressures. Some fascinating stuff here.
You know, we've got this really cool set of sources you sent over, and we're going to use Wisconsin and Brexit to sort of as our case studies.
Interesting choices.
Yeah.
Seemingly different, but there are connections there. Surprising ones, even.
Right. And one expert even calls factory closures in the Midwest, you know, the American Midwest, and the rise of that populism in Northern England, like two sides of the same coin.
It's all connected.
So today, we're going to unpack that, figure out why that is, and even look at what this all means for democracies, like globally.
Big picture stuff. We're going to go beyond just what happened and get into the why. You know, what's underneath it all, what caused all this, and how it ripples outward.
Like putting together a puzzle.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to start with Paula Livingstone's blog post, The Shared Strains of Democracy.
Good place to start.
Yeah, she really lays out the case that these issues democracies face, they're not just a U.S. thing or a U.K. thing. They're everywhere.
Globally, yeah. It's interesting. Livingstone compares it to a medical diagnosis. Like different countries, they might have different medical histories, but they can still end up with, you know, similar symptoms.
Oh, like a larger underlying condition.
Exactly. And in this case, it's those intense pressures that democracies are facing now in the 21st century.
And one of those pressures is like economic disparity. Like Livingstone's post points out that in the U.S. you've got these places like San Francisco and New York that are like booming.
Right.
But then rural Wisconsin is really struggling.
And across the pond, same deal. London's thriving while those old industrial towns in Northern England are declining.
Yeah.
And it's not just about numbers and statistics, though. It's about the people in those struggling places feeling like the system just doesn't work for them anymore.
Right, they feel let down.
Imagine, you're a factory worker in Janesville, Wisconsin. You've worked hard your whole life, you know, played by the rules, and then, boom, the GM plant shuts down.
Gone, just like that.
Your livelihood's gone.
Yeah.
And it's tough to not feel resentful. Like that whole American dream thing, it just passed you by.
Yeah, totally. Makes sense that people would feel left behind.
And Livingstone argues that that economic anxiety is made even worse by another pressure. Misinformation.
Especially with social media, right?
Huge factor. Think back to the 2016 U.S. election and the Brexit referendum. Misinformation was all over the place.
Mm.
Really played on people's fears.
Yeah, it's like social media is this double-edged sword, right? It gives everyone a voice, which is great, but it also creates these echo chambers where people only see information that backs up what they already think.
Exactly. And so Livingstone's argument is all this feeds into a third pressure, which is the erosion of trust. In institutions.
Oh, like people just stop trusting the media, the government, experts, you name it.
Yeah, anyone who seems to be in charge. People feel economically marginalized. They're overwhelmed with all this conflicting information. And so they just start to lose faith.
Makes you feel pretty powerless, I bet.
Yeah, and it becomes this vicious cycle. The more people feel left behind, the less they trust the very people who are supposed to be representing them.
And this is where our deep dive into Wisconsin and Brexit really starts to take shape. Livingstone uses them as like real world examples of how these pressures play out.
Exactly. So she argues that Wisconsin, it's like a microcosm of what's happening in rural America.
Yeah.
You know, people picture Wisconsin and they think dairy farms and cheese, like this idyllic place.
Right, right.
But underneath it all, there's this whole story of economic transformation and this deep discontent.
It's not just economics, though, right?
No, Livingstone points out this growing cultural divide, too, between urban and rural areas. And this isn't just Wisconsin. It's all over the U.S.
It's like two completely different worlds, different values, different priorities. Take something like environmental regulations.
Okay, yeah.
People in cities, they might see those regulations as essential, you know, to protect the planet. But people in rural communities, they might see those same regulations as, like, a threat to their livelihood.
Absolutely. Two very different perspectives. And those differences just feed into that feeling of being overlooked and misunderstood, you know, that Livingstone talks about.
Yeah, like they don't matter.
Right. Rural communities often feel like their concerns, they're just not being heard, not being taken seriously by the elites in the big cities.
It makes me think of that book, The Politics of Resentment, that Livingstone mentioned. You know, it really digs into those frustrations that rural Americans have, this feeling of being ignored by the political establishment.
And not just disagree on policies, it's deeper than that.
Yeah.
It's like their whole way of life is being dismissed.
Exactly. So to really get what happened in Wisconsin and places like it, we need to understand these these emotional undercurrents, like that sense of resentment that's brewing beneath the surface.
It's key. Okay, so we've got economic hardship, cultural divides, this simmering resentment. Now let's shift gears to the UK and Brexit. Livingston makes it very clear that Brexit was about way more than just the EU. It was like all this discontent just bubbling over.
A breaking point.
Yeah. She draws some interesting parallels between the UK and Wisconsin. She points to those former industrial powerhouses in northern England, places like Stoke-on-Trent, Sunderland. They experienced that same kind of decline as Janesville, Wisconsin.
That hollowing out of industry.
Exactly. They felt the sting of globalization, that feeling of being left behind as the economy shifted.
Like the world changed around them.
Yeah, and then this economic anxiety got all tangled up with questions of identity and sovereignty. For a lot of Britons, the EU became this symbol of lost control.
Oh, I see. So they're feeling like decisions were being made by people they didn't elect. Those bureaucrats in Brussels.
Exactly. And there were concerns about immigration, too.
Right, right. So that slogan, take back control, it was so powerful during the Brexit campaign.
Hugely powerful.
Because it tapped into this deep desire for agency, to have control over their lives, their country.
Livingston's arguing that Brexit was just as much about those regional disparities, those identity crises, as it was about, like, specific EU policies.
It was like a breaking point for all those simmering frustrations.
Exactly. And here's the thing. Both Wisconsin and Brexit, they weren't just isolated incidents. They're both part of this bigger trend, this wave of discontent that's hitting democracies around the world. And that's what we'll explore in the next part of our deep dive. How these issues are playing out globally, and what we might be able to do about it.
Stay with us for that. So we've got democracies all over feeling the pressure. We've got Wisconsin, Brexit, these prime examples of how all this economic anxiety, these cultural divides, the whole erosion of trust thing, they're playing out in the real world. But Livingstone, she doesn't, you know, just leave us with a doom and gloom scenario.
No, not at all.
She actually gives us some ways to bridge these divides and, you know, make democracy stronger for like the 21st century.
She offers some hope, some solutions.
Yeah, and she starts with something that's so simple it's easy to miss. Just talking to each other.
Sounds obvious, right?
But not just like, you know, yelling at each other on social media. Like real conversations where people actually listen, try to understand different points of view.
That's the key. Listening.
She calls it grassroots dialogue, creating spaces where people with different backgrounds, you know, even totally opposite views, can come together and have these constructive conversations.
It's about building bridges instead of walls.
I get it, but it does sound, I don't know, almost too simple.
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
In our world, everything's so polarized, right? We're in our own echo chambers.
Yeah.
Just having a civil conversation with someone who sees things differently politically, it can feel almost revolutionary.
That's true, actually.
That's why Livingston put so much emphasis on it. We got to move past this us versus them thing. Remember, we're all human. We share a common humanity.
We don't have to agree on everything.
Exactly. But we can at least try to understand where the other side is coming from.
She gives some great examples of this actually happening, like Better Angels in the U.S. They bring people from totally opposite ends of the political spectrum together.
For workshops, dialogues. Trying to find common ground.
And in the UK, there's Britain Talks doing a similar thing, you know, pairing people with opposing views on Brexit just to have these face-to-face conversations.
What's interesting about these initiatives is the goal isn't to convert people. It's about empathy, about understanding.
Yeah, sometimes just listening to someone can be so powerful.
It can help break down those stereotypes and prejudices that fuel so much of this division.
Like that saying, you don't have to agree with someone to respect them.
Exactly. It's acknowledging that even people we disagree with, they have valid reasons for feeling the way they do.
But dialogue, talking, it's not going to solve everything, right? We still have to deal with those economic anxieties that are behind a lot of the anger, the frustration.
That's a huge part of the equation.
So what does Livingstone say about that? Does she give us anything concrete besides just talking?
She does. She really makes a strong case for what she calls targeted economic policies. It's about moving away from those one-size-fits-all solutions.
Like recognizing that different places have different needs.
Exactly. What works for Silicon Valley, it's not going to work for Janesville, Wisconsin.
So instead of trying to apply the same solution everywhere, it's more about like tailoring those policies to each region, you know, playing to their strengths, addressing their specific challenges.
She talks about investing in infrastructure, setting up localized education programs, fostering those economic opportunities that really align with the unique assets of each area.
It's smart.
She even brings up the UK's leveling up agenda, which is trying to do just that, you know, address regional imbalances by investing in infrastructure, education, job creation in those places that have been left behind.
Like a tailored approach to specific communities. It makes a lot of sense.
Because a struggling factory town in the Midwest, it's going to need a different approach than say, a booming tech hub on the coast.
Different problems, different solutions.
Right. And Livingston, she gets into some really creative solutions, too. She argues that culture can be a really powerful bridge between people. Think art, music, literature, even food.
Shared experiences.
Exactly. Yeah. It's those things that can connect people on a deeper level, you know, beyond those political and ideological differences.
I like that. Oh. Using culture to bring people together.
It's not just about politicians in a room arguing over policy. It's about people connecting as human beings.
She mentions the UK City of Culture Initiative, which is a great example. They choose a different city each year as like a cultural hub with all these events and activities.
Yeah, it's not just about tourism and money. It's about showcasing what that community has to offer, celebrating diversity, building that sense of pride.
And hopefully a little bit of unity.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got dialogue, targeted economic policies, these cultural initiatives. It sounds like a multi-pronged approach, you know, hitting this from different angles.
Because that's what's needed. It's complex. There's no one simple answer.
No silver bullet.
Right. It's got to be a holistic strategy that tackles the economic, the social, the cultural dimensions of this whole discontent. Everything's intertwined.
Okay, let's move on to something that's been in the news a lot. Populism. Livingstone spends a whole section on this, and she makes this interesting point.
Lay it on me.
She says populism isn't the problem. It's like a symptom of a deeper problem.
Oh, that's interesting, because populism is often portrayed as this dangerous force, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's a threat to democracy. It's easy to get caught up in that whole us versus them narrative.
Yeah, but we have to look deeper. Ask ourselves, like, why is this populism thing growing? What's driving it? What needs, what grievances is it tapping into?
Maybe it's telling us something about how our systems are failing.
Right, like instead of just dismissing it as dangerous, maybe we should try to understand it.
Livingston points out that populism often pops up in places where people feel ignored, abandoned, you know, like those rural communities we talked about.
The forgotten places.
That feeling of being forgotten, overlooked by the elites, that's what creates the perfect environment for populist leaders, these people who promise simple solutions to complex problems.
Yeah, they offer easy answers.
And she makes a similar point about Brexit. That take back control message, it hit a nerve because people felt like they had lost control over their own lives, their country's future. They wanted someone to blame, someone to fight for them.
And those populist leaders, they offered that.
It's interesting how she connects this rise in populism back to that loss of trust we were talking about before. When people don't trust institutions anymore, they become more vulnerable to these populist appeals, to those easy answers and scapegoats.
It's like the more people feel disillusioned, the more they turn to those who offer simple solutions, even if those solutions aren't realistic, even if they're divisive.
It feeds on itself. But if we follow Livingston's logic, maybe instead of just demonizing populism, we should see it as a signal, a red flag.
Like something's broken.
She's saying, don't just dismiss these movements outright. Listen to what they're saying. What grievances are they airing, even if you don't agree with their solutions?
It's like a doctor with a patient.
Yeah.
You don't just treat the symptoms. You got to figure out what's causing the illness, get to the root of it.
Exactly. And that leads us to one of the most important elements in all of this, trust.
Livingstone keeps hammering this home trust is the foundation of a functioning democracy. If people don't trust their institutions, the whole thing starts to crumble.
No foundation, no structure.
Why would anyone participate in a system, follow the laws, pay taxes, if they don't believe it works for them? If they think the people in charge don't care?
It makes sense. You lose faith, you check out.
Livingstone brings up the declining trust in the U.S., those Gallup polls that show it just eroding over the years.
Yeah, pretty bleak picture.
And it's not just the government. It's the media, experts, anyone in a position of power.
This ties directly back to that discontent we see in places like Wisconsin. People feel ignored, so they stop trusting the system. And that opens the door for those populist leaders who exploit that lack of trust.
They take advantage.
Right, and it's not just happening in America. Livingstone talks about a similar pattern in the UK before Brexit. She even mentions that Michael Gove, one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, he actually said, "The people of this country have had enough of experts."
Wow, talk about distrust.
It shows this deep skepticism of knowledge, of expertise, which often goes hand in hand with populism.
And Livingstone argues that this distrust is partly driven by misinformation, especially all that stuff on social media.
It's hard to know what to believe these days.
We live in a world where it's getting harder and harder to tell what's true and what's not. She gives the example of that that claim during the Brexit campaign that the UK sends £350 million a week to the EU that could go to the NHS instead.
Yeah, that was totally false.
But it went viral, and it influenced how people voted.
This is where media literacy becomes so important. We got to equip people with the tools to sort through all this information, to identify bias, you know, recognize propaganda.
It's not just about what we consume, it's about how we consume it.
Being critical thinkers, being aware.
It's about being active participants, not just passive recipients. We got to be skeptical, ask questions, be willing to challenge our own assumptions.
It's a lot to ask, but it's crucial in this crazy information environment we live in. And rebuilding trust, it's not just about what individuals do. Institutions have a role to play too.
So how do we fix this? How do we get people to trust institutions again?
Livingstone argues it requires transparency and accountability. Institutions got to be open about what they're doing, and they have to answer to the people they serve.
Like, prove they're working for us.
She has a really fascinating example, Iceland's post-crisis reforms. After the 2008 financial crisis, they didn't just prosecute those who caused it. They actually brought citizens in to help write a new constitution.
Wow, that's putting your money where your mouth is. Really showing they're committed to doing things differently.
It's a powerful example of how to rebuild trust. Not just talk, but action. Showing you're serious about serving the public. And it's a reminder that it can be done. It's tough, but it's not impossible.
Okay, so we've talked about dialogue, economic solutions, understanding populism, rebuilding trust. It's a lot, a whole bunch of different approaches. But Livingstone doesn't stop there. She really emphasizes that Wisconsin and Brexit, they're not just these isolated events, they're part of something bigger, a global pattern. So let's zoom out and look at how these issues are playing out around Latterold. She argues we're seeing similar strains on democracies everywhere. She points to the rise of populist parties in Europe. That Yellow Vest movement in France is a prime example.
Interesting. What's striking about the Yellow Vest is how much they have in common with, you know, the discontent we see in rural America.
Like, even though France and the U.S. are so different, politically, historically, they're both experiencing that same disconnect between the people and the elites.
That feeling that the system just doesn't work for the average person.
Yeah, that those in power are out of touch. So it's not just a Western thing either. Livingstone also points to, like, identity politics and religious nationalism in India, another example of these divisions.
That's global.
She compares those Brexit concerns about, you know, national sovereignty to the rise of Hindu nationalism in India. It's a reminder that these issues are all wrapped up in questions of identity and belonging.
It's about people searching for meaning, for community, in a world that feels increasingly fragmented and uncertain.
And Livingstone brings up those electoral tensions in Africa, too, using Kenya as an example.
Where ethnic divides can really fuel political instability.
Yeah, she highlights how the post-election violence in Kenya back in 2007, 2008, it was driven partly by those ethnic rivalries that, you know, that politicians exploited for their own gain.
A reminder of how dangerous these divisions can be when they're not addressed.
It's a lot to take in. Makes you realize that what we see in Wisconsin, Brexit, it's just like the tip of the iceberg.
Livingstone's point is these are worldwide problems and they need worldwide solutions. We got to learn from each other, share ideas, work together to make democratic institutions stronger globally.
So what are some of those solutions? Livingstone gives us a few concrete things, but what do you think are the most promising ways to fix these cracks in democracy?
Well, I think it has to start with recognizing that we're all in this together. We can't keep thinking one group wins and another loses, you know, zero-sum game. We need to feel that shared responsibility for our democratic systems and work towards something more inclusive, something more equitable, something that benefits everyone.
It's about unity, not division.
And I think Livingstone's work gives us a good place to start. She gives us a way to understand these complex issues and some tools to actually start addressing them.
I'm actually feeling more hopeful after this conversation. Livingstone's message is ultimately a positive one, you know? She's not saying democracy is doomed. She's saying we need to be proactive. We need to be engaged. We need to adapt. That's powerful.
It is. And it's not just for politicians and policymakers. It's for all of us. Every citizen has a role to play in shaping the future of democracy.
So what can we do besides just feeling hopeful?
Keep exploring, keep learning, keep asking questions, and maybe most importantly, keep talking to each other. Have those conversations, even when they're tough.
We hope this deep dive has given you something to think about and maybe some tools to navigate these really challenging times. Thanks for joining us. Okay, so we've gone global here from like the American Midwest to Europe. We even touched on India and Africa. It's clear that these strains, these pressures on democracy, they're not just some local thing. But before we wrap up this whole deep dive, I want to focus on what we can actually do about all this. Like, what can people do? Livingstone gives us some actual steps we can take, and they're pretty inspiring.
It's easy to feel, I think, overwhelmed, you know, by how big these problems are. But Livingstone, she reminds us that we're not powerless. She lays out this kind of roadmap, focuses on a few key areas where our efforts can actually make a real difference.
And the first one, she keeps coming back to this, is dialogue. You know, we talked about those initiatives, Better Angels, Britain Talks, but she goes deeper than that. It's not just about organized events. It's about having those good, constructive conversations in our everyday lives.
Think about it this way. You're having dinner with someone who has like completely different political views than you. And instead of just arguing, you really try to listen, to understand their perspective. You might not change each other's minds, but you walk away with a deeper understanding of where they're coming from, why they see things the way they do.
That's a great image. Like breaking bread together.
Yeah.
Finding that common ground even when you disagree on things. But I also think about like young people,
yeah,
who maybe don't even know how to have those kinds of conversations.
Right.
They've grown up online, echo chambers, shouting matches on social media.
And that's why Livingstone puts so much emphasis on education, specifically what she calls media literacy.
Okay, yeah.
It's about giving people the tools to navigate all this information, to figure out what's real, what's not. It's tricky out there. Like take Sweden, for example. They've actually made critical thinking and source evaluation like part of their school curriculum.
Whoa, starting young.
Yeah.
That's amazing though. Like imagine if we were all taught how to spot fake news, to identify bias, to really think critically about the information that we're taking in from a young age.
It wouldn't solve everything, but it would give people a much stronger foundation to have those good constructive conversations that Livingstone talks about.
Right, because if you can't even agree on what's true, it's pretty hard to have a productive conversation.
Exactly.
Okay, so dialogue's key. Education lays the groundwork. But we can't just ignore those real economic anxieties that are driving so much of this discontent.
It's at the heart of it for a lot of people.
So what do we do about that? What does Livingstone suggest?
She's adamant that we need to move beyond those short-term fixes, those Band-Aid solutions, and really tackle those economic disparities head on.
Yeah, but it can't just be about throwing money at the problem.
No, absolutely not. It's got to be more strategic.
Like smarter. More targeted.
Exactly. She's a big advocate for what she calls equitable growth policies.
Okay.
Which are policies that are specifically designed to address the needs of different regions. Think targeted investments, rural development initiatives,
mm-hmm.
infrastructure projects that create jobs and opportunities in those areas that have been left behind.
It's kind of like that leveling up agenda that we talked about in the UK, but applied more broadly.
Exactly. It's recognizing that different communities have different needs and those solutions have to be tailored to those needs.
It's like acknowledging that a one-size-fits-all approach isn't going to work.
She also talks about the importance of government being more responsive to the needs of its citizens, more proactive.
So not just like handing down solutions from on high.
Right. It's about creating systems where people are empowered to succeed.
Opportunities, not handouts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to, I think, Livingstone's most important point.
Lay it on me.
Transparency and accountability.
Okay, yeah.
If we want people to trust institutions, those institutions have got to be transparent in what they do. They've got to be accountable to the people they serve. Remember that example of Iceland's post-crisis reforms?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
They didn't just punish the people who were responsible for the financial crisis. They brought citizens in to help draft a whole new constitution.
That's really putting your money where your mouth is.
It shows a real commitment to doing things differently, to serving the public good, and it proves that it can be done. It's not easy, but it's possible.
It gives me hope.
Me too. And ultimately, that's Livingston's message. She acknowledges how big these challenges are that democracies are facing today, but she doesn't want us to feel hopeless.
Right. She ends on a hopeful note. She argues that we have the power to fix these things, to create a better democracy, a more inclusive democracy, one that's more resilient, more representative, you know, for the 21st century.
And that brings it back to all of us listening. What does this mean for you? How can you be a part of making that positive change?
I know. I feel inspired. I feel like I want to do something. And it starts with those small everyday actions, like having respectful conversations, staying informed, holding our leaders accountable.
Supporting initiatives like Better Angels, Britain Talks, or even finding ways to get involved in your own community.
And don't underestimate the power of just listening. Listening to people who see things differently than you do. You might learn something. You might even find some common ground that you didn't expect.
Because at the end of the day, democracy, it thrives on participation, on people getting involved, being engaged. That constant conversation between the people and the institutions that are supposed to represent them.
So keep learning, keep asking questions, and most importantly, keep those conversations going. We hope this deep dive has given you some things to think about and maybe some tools to help you navigate these really challenging times. Thanks for joining us.